Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the Stack Overflow podcast, a place to talk all things software and technology. I'm your host, Ben Popper. We have some great guests today. This is a sponsored episode with some folks from MongoDB and Google Cloud. And we are going to be chit-chatting about the Gen AI space and about LLMs, but getting into a bit of the nitty-gritty, you know, not just at a high level, but what does it take to build it? What does it take to maintain it when you have production at scale? You know, what's it like for developers who work on this, who are being asked to do things like fine tuning? So I'm very excited. We have three great guests today. What love for them to introduce themselves. Mira, would you start for us?
Yeah, sure. Hi, everyone. My name is Dani Miravoeva. I'm a senior developer advocate at MongoDB.
Thank you, Ben and Ryan, for having me on the podcast. I'm Shane McAllister. I'm based in Limerick in Ireland, and I'm a lead on the developer relations team here at MongoDB. I'm very much looking forward to our conversation.
Hey, everyone. I'm Miku Jha, and I'm director of Google Cloud Partner Engineering for GenAI. Really glad and happy to be here with all of you and talk all things considered GenAI and otherwise. So I run Google Cloud Partner Engineering for Generative AI. So a lot of our focus is essentially on what really needs to happen. What is that repeatable recipe which can take us to the killer enterprise-focused apps? And we work on that day in and day out, not just from the platform perspective, but also about how do we build our partner ecosystem and move that, propel that forward. So again, very glad to be here with all of you and share some of those thoughts.
So, you know, Ryan and I have been trying to write and think a lot about this stuff. Stack Overflow, you know, has its own efforts going in the AI space, as well as recently announcing a partnership with Gemini to, you know, help their models get better by training on some of the data our community creates. LLMs and Gen AI, you know, it's a pretty rich technical space, and we've talked about a lot of that. But after everyone's played with the models and done their experimentation, you know, what's the business case for investing the time and the talent that it takes to really operationalize this within a, you know, large enterprise organization? So I would put that out to all of you, maybe based on some of the work you've seen with partners or with each other.
Yeah, I can take a first shot at it because we are working through this exact same question right now with almost every single global system integrator and regional integrators at scale. And the way we are seeing it is, if you think about it, 80% of adoption, the time spent today, is still in that early phase of experimentation, trying to figure out what it is, doing, you know, pilots, MVPs, hackathons, and all of that. If you think of it in terms of wave, then the first wave that we are seeing is where you can call it more as a solve, where we are optimizing for productivity gains. So think of simple, like, out-of-box solutions, some very basic integration and internal workflows. And the goal here is productivity gains, or you're really trying to impact the cost base of the organization. So that's where I would say, if I just took a back of the envelope guess, 30 to 40% of adoption we are seeing there. And then it gets hard. So you're only, like, maybe best case scenario, 15%, where you're saying, okay, I know what I want to do. And you start by plumbing, meaning that you're trying to now do the back office integration, bring the workflows together, do the integrations at many different component level. And here, the impact that you want to get to, which is aspirational, is to improve your customer interactions. So think of all the applications like customer support or HR automation or legal automation and all of that. That bucket we are just starting to see, because there is an overlap, right? It's not like I'm going to do wave one and go to wave two. You have a significant overlap. We are not anywhere near where we want to be in that really aspirational killer apps. It's a complete white space, and maybe it's less than 5% of adoption where you would say, okay, I'm going to get to this massive monetization. I'm going to create new product, new offerings, and do a cross-industry change. That, I would say, we are at least 18 to 24 months away from seeing those trends.
Hmm. Yeah, from my side, I think, obviously, I'd echo everything Miku has said. I think very much that the fact that we're at the early stages of a lot of this. And the question, Ben, was, you know, the business case. I think a lot of that is still being explored. I think in most instances, when we see people talk about using Gen AI, it's about enhancing productivity and efficiency, innovating product services, improving customer experience, and obviously, you know, cost reductions as well, too. And somewhere in the mix, there becomes competitive advantage, I think so. And if I look at, you know, if I wear my MongoDB hat and I look at how we're treating this space, for us, it's about enhanced decision-making based on accessibility to data and be able to kind of analyze that data and to get back, you know, insights from vast, vast amounts of data to identify trends and patterns that wouldn't be obvious without using AI tools, for example, to support decision-making in that respect. And I think the other thing, too, that is key for most companies in looking at the business case, you know, as we all know, it's a kind of crowded market for developers and for talent and for the best minds at this space. So I think AI is also part of maybe companies' talent acquisition strategies and retention strategies. Developers want to be engaged. Developers want to be challenged. And I think what's happening now, and from my conversations with developers, is this is a fresh new world for a lot of them. You know, they don't have to have, you know, 15 years of experience under their belt. Okay, right. They might have in the machine learning world.
A lot of greenfield. Yeah. I think you make an excellent point.
Yeah, I was going to say, Shane, that's really interesting because on one end, you touch on the spectrum of being overcrowded, right? Like, but on the other end, what we are seeing is not for basic integrations, but when you're really thinking of building complex apps where you really need to have that understanding of the MLOps or LLM instrumentation, there is a clear talent gap, right? Like you just don't have in-house expertise to even really excel at maybe something from basic to intermediate, like prompt engineering, right? So it's kind of, you know, really interesting to see both these things interplaying at exactly the same time. We are seeing so many use cases where if you said, hey, what is the top three blockers? Talent gap would be in that top three today. All our interactions and discussions with our end customers and partners.
Definitely. Yeah, I think that's really interesting. Mira, you want to weigh in on it at all? Or?
Yeah, going back to the use cases, I think the audience that is ripe for this is the developer audience. I think we're the first people who started using the chat assistants. And I think that any AI tool that is targeted towards developers, so anything to do with developer tooling, will be very successful and will find a good feedback from its customers.
Yeah. You know, we were addressing the idea of the business case. And Miku, like there are a couple of things you said I really love, you know, that so much of it is experimentation, that so little of it is actually in production. But, you know, in my mind, I can think of a few things where it seems like it might be in production at scale. You know, image generation, which I've been playing around with like a Midjourney for a while and using it for graphic design. That kind of stuff is now baked into Adobe, and I imagine people are just using it on a pretty regular basis. You know, when I look at, you know, something like ChatGPT, you know, I'm sure it's doing a lot of people's homework every single day, right? and Stack Overflow is helping them as well. And then when it comes to code gen, you know, like is built into a lot of IDEs, and a lot of people just are hitting tab and, you know, getting some code. So let's look at, you know, those three as examples. One's image generation, one's text generation, one's code generation. What stops those kinds of things from becoming reality at scale? Like if, you know, those three have obviously achieved it, but when you think about what the challenges are, like what did they have to achieve to be serving millions or tens of millions of customers every day and, you know, trying to serve them with relatively low latency and high accuracy?
Yeah, well, I you touched on code generation, and it's a project that I've been closely involved here in MongoDB with what we're, you know, helping the tools that developers are using day to day be better at MongoDB. Be that queries, functions, you know, just basic CRUD, everything. We want to make sure that obviously MongoDB is a known entity for a lot of these code assistants, you know. So if a developer is looking to leverage MongoDB, that they're getting the right answers from their code completion tool as well, too. And I think to touch on kind of, I suppose, how we get to that scale, I was surprised and still am surprised with the sheer scale of what's required to train foundational models in AI, you know, and the challenges that that in itself brings about in terms of, you know, data and quality and content quality and the availability of that. So when the DevRel team and others in MongoDB were set upon to help train these code completion tools, you know, we weren't providing just the code that's in our docs. We were put upon to provide, you know, 10x more code than we have in our own docs about how to work with MongoDB. We were asked to come up with, you know, not just a single prompt for, you know, a set piece of code as an example, but multiple versions of those prompts using natural language. So, you know, how and which ways will a developer ask to connect to a MongoDB collection, for example? And this was a total change of mindset for us on the team that were working on these, in particular, code completion and code assistance, because it was a very different space for us, you know. And that in itself brings its challenges of integration, brings its challenges of scale as well, too. And also maintenance. We need to keep these tools up to date with how to work with the latest services, products, suite of features that MongoDB have as well, too. So, you know, these are serious challenges. So to go back to your question about, you know, very few and what Miku said at the beginning, get to production at scale.
Yeah.
You know, these are hard tasks that AI is solving at the moment with huge teams of, you know, developers, data scientists, and who knows what behind them as well.
Yeah. I'd like to hear from both of you. Just to sort of touch on that for a second before you hop on, two things you said that I wanted to highlight. One is data quality, right? Like you might have to go out and get 10x the data that you had. How are you going to do that? Is it going to be, you know, synthetic or created in-house? And then, yeah, the prompt engineering that goes into it. You know, I heard, you know, a leader from one of the top AI companies speaking recently on a podcast saying, our model is great and everybody thinks our model is super, you know, important, but actually it was the, you know, reinforcement learning with human feedback at the end that made the experience so good. It was all that testing and tweaking and prodding and coaching and prompt engineering that allowed the models to deliver a great experience. Anyway, I'll pass the mic. Go ahead.
No, thanks. I think Ben and Shane, both of you touched on it, which I think is, I can't talk enough about, which is essentially data foundation and data maturity, right? Because that's at the heart of taking anything, even a simple use case, into production, even if you're not thinking scale, just for your internal consumption. And it's a lot of work and it's a lot of effort, because even if you say you want to take a basic foundation model and do some simple RAG, right, to connect it with your private corpus of enterprise data, it becomes effort where, again, you go back to, do you have the right skill? Do you have the data in the right state? Do you understand what it means to utilize that data from governance perspective before you feed it into your RAG framework, right? And, you know, I would also like to differentiate between consumer-focused solutions and enterprise-focused solutions, because the challenges become significantly different, right? Like when you are thinking enterprise, you, at least I would say 25 to 30% of applications do not cross from ideation to deployment at scale, not because of the technical challenges, but because of everything else. Because you have to make a decision on what would that output from the model have as an impact on your brand equity. You want to figure out, do you really have your governance in place? Have you stripped off all the PII information from it? And if not, what happens? So I think those challenges are much bigger, which we don't have like a holistic strategy to say, I'm going to feed it into this repeatable pipeline. I have the process sorted out. I'm going to start cranking the use cases, right? So that's where we see big blockers. Of course, on the technical front, you know, we talk a little bit, I think, in the direction of MLOps, right? Instrumentation, managing the lifecycle and all of that. I feel that need is going to go lower and lower because a lot of these capabilities are now in the platform, right? Like if I take Vertex AI as an example, then we have shared model evaluation, artifacts, metadata management, the whole life cycle, that's there. But the other things that I talked about, those still have to come together for enterprises to have this comfort of taking it at scale and putting their brand, putting their data behind it.
Yeah, I think we're going to get into this in the next question, and it's one that really interests me, which is, you know, to what degree is the use of Gen AI via a cloud provider starting to feel like other cloud services, whereas you said, in the background, they're handling a lot of stuff for you invisibly that is, you know, architectural or infrastructure based or kind of your site reliability engineering type of, you know, stuff versus, right, like them just giving you a model and you combining that with your data and then boom, you know, something comes out. The output that comes out on the other side is, you know, increasing productivity at the enterprise. But Mira, let me let you weigh in on this question if you'd like before I move on to the next one. Just the idea of like, yeah, like when you see folks working on this kind of thing, what are the big challenges of making it a reality at enterprise scale?
I think it's a good thing that these models and the whole Gen AI services are provided as managed services as part of some cloud provider. And I believe one of the big promises of generative AI is that anyone can have access to advanced machine learning models without needing to have background in machine learning. So any developer can take the model, write a prompt that is in natural language and make it do a hard task, perform a hard task that is otherwise really hard to achieve with a specific machine learning model. So I think that being part of a bigger solution in coming from a cloud provider is actually a good thing. It's not a disadvantage in this case.
Mira, to your point, right, I also want to share that when it comes to any kind of a platform, right, like why are you using a platform? You're using a platform so that a lot of these things can get standardized. And why do you care about standardization is because what we are seeing is that across any given enterprise, you're not kind of investing in one or two apps. You're looking at 50, 70, 80, 100 apps because it's every sub-function of the organization that hypothetically, but will become a reality, can benefit from it, whether it's your HR, whether it's your marketing, whether it's your engineering. So you're seeing that push of magnitude. And then what that also means is that from any platform that you think about, it's about choice. It's not about a specific LLM model. There's not going to be a paradigm where one model rules it all for your, you know, spectrum of use cases. So what you're seeing is optionality, whether you are talking about multi-model capabilities or whether you're talking about multiple models. On average, you have 6 models being invested in today, even for a medium-sized enterprise. So you are going to have a combination.
Interesting.
Open source, small language models, LLMs, multi-models, all of that. And it needs to fit into that framework of where you are experimenting and exploring and iterating, right?
Right. Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, it did seem for my 5 years at Stack Overflow that the company continues to transition to what is, you know, becoming best practice, which is, you know, we have some on-prem, we have hybrid cloud across different providers. And that is, you know, just in the best interest of the company and continues to push the market forward. You know, it's healthy overall.
Well, I think just to add, you know, for me, you know, we're kind of, it's a bit more art than science at the moment with regard to model, you know, design and selection of models. And at the beginning, there was only a few models to choose from. And now we've got so much more. And they're all, you know, look, we've got our text models, our image models, audio, video models, whatever that might be, and every variation in between. And I think to go back to the original question about, you know, being able to choose a provider that has a broad spectrum of models available, that has a model garden library that you can go in there and experiment as well, too, to make sure that you're, you know, there's a bit of trial and error involved in getting this just right. Mira's just completed a demo for Cloud Next for us as well, too. So, you know, we need to decide on a number of things for these selection of which models. So being able to go in via Model Garden and choose and play around with in a relatively safe space, still within your proof of concept, not in a production world, but still within your proof of concept, is super critical. And there's so many more layers to this that I think, you know, we're seeing, like in the same move to the cloud space that we were a number of years ago, we're seeing the same sort of choices needed to be made of this space, because that could be success or fail in the future of your product, your application, or your service.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. You know, it definitely has come across a few times in conversations we had on the podcast that one of the challenges here is these things are not always as deterministic as software developers are used to. And you've got to poke and prod and play with them to find the best one. And then, yeah, to your point, I've been thinking about writing a piece, you know, with a clickbait headline, something along the lines of like, nobody cares how smart, you know, your model is, because they're all very cutting edge and there's dozens of new ones every week, right? Like what people care about, back to, you know, what we were talking earlier, is like, does it fit and can I prove out the business value and is it managed, you know, in a way that allows my organization to run it, even if we don't have in-house talent, you know, to necessarily be on top of all these things.
To your point, like, you know, I continuously keep a check of how many models are there in Google's Vertex AI. So today we are at 134. So I'm like, when I share that, it's exactly what you said. It's like, great. Where do I start? Right. And the other thing is that, you know, you want to experiment, you want to iterate fast, you're going to choose a different model for that. But when you want to take that same use case to production, you have to think of different trade-offs. But you don't really know today, for the use cases you're experimenting with, that what would be your workload in production, right? Because you haven't been through that journey enough times to have those estimates. And that's what, that is also something which makes it really tricky. And, you know, Mira and Shane, I would love your perspective on this, because what we are finding as a question is that, okay, I'm experimenting it, I chose some model, but I'm still investing a lot of effort in my prompt, in plumbing the infrastructure and all of that. But as I continue my journey, my model is going to change. What happens to the effort I invested in prompt engineering to get that model A to meet my expectations? But I know I have to go to a model B. Am I forced to start from scratch? Or is there anything I can leverage from time to value perspective, right? Like, there are many perspectives on this, but I would love if you have come across that, or, you know, any thoughts on solve for that.
Mira, you've been playing around with a lot of these recently. Any thoughts?
Yeah, it's a fun journey because you're always interacting in the exact same way with these models and you're kind of expecting a similar output, but that's not really the case. So yeah, you have a natural language input and you have all sorts of outputs and parameters that you can control to make the models less creative or more creative, but they all have very different outputs. And I believe there are like some really good benchmarks out there that you can use for your, not for your proof of concept, but for your solutions that need to scale. But yeah, I guess it's a challenge to invest time and benchmark all these models and decide which is most cost effective, which is best for your use case in the long term.
Right.
It is. It is a challenge all the time because, you know, if you choose a model, you might, like, there's concepts of overfitting or underfitting those models. So, you know, it might perform super well on the training data. As you say, you're teaching it, right, by the things you're doing with those models. And it might then subsequently perform really poorly on any unseen data. And as you move from, you know, essentially kind of what we're talking about, that gap, that production gap, Miku, that you were mentioning, you know, this overfitting, underfitting is a big issue. But there's also a speed element, in my view, because there's an obsolescence risk. You need to get your app out there. You need to get your product out there. We've all seen Gen AI space move so swiftly, certainly in the last 18 months, it seems, but obviously it's been super speedy most of the time, you know, that you get something, you launch it, you put it out there, there's a new model, you know, exactly. there's something that better than what you use to base your product on. So this is super hard, necessitating kind of reevaluation, updates, refactoring, who knows?
Right. Yeah, it's an interesting new paradigm, right? It's not just, okay, you know, there's a new version of the software, and when we roll that out, we're going to test for a few bugs. It's, I put all this time and effort into making sure that my data worked well with this model, but now I'd like to move to this fancy new one. And we had a guest on recently who works at, you know, one of the larger financial institutions, and is, you know, putting out content, educational content in the Gen AI space. talking about merging models now, and, you know, the people experimenting with, can you put them together? And could that be a way of, all right, well, I know it works with Model A, and but I'd like to get a little of Model B, and, you know, figuring out how to merge the parameters and stuff like that. So yeah, a lot of greenfield and a lot of art over science, which is, I guess, what makes it fun. All right. So one thing that I want to make sure we hit on before we finish is a bit of, yeah, the manual work involved in the training. We've talked about sort of like at a high level, you know, we're sort of going in reverse order from the most abstract all down, getting closer to the metal here. So in terms of training and fine tuning, you know, you hear about, okay, this took a certain number of weeks on a certain number of GPUs. And, you know, then there's a usually a big dollar sign at the end of that. But how much manual work and babysitting is involved in training and fine tuning? You know, how can it go off course? And then after we cover those two, I'd love to go a little bit into sort of like, is there maintenance and upkeep and ongoing cost considerations when you have a model in production? Now we're hypothetically talking about it in production as if that were happening.
Well, I think from our own experience on the code assistance, you know, the fine tuning was where we were involved. You know, we did an evaluation of these code assistants before we even started to do this. You know, we came back with some new content, new data, new parameters to give it to try and fine tune it a little bit better. And there are windows of tuning with most of these companies who provide these models as well too. So it's, I'll give you this and, you know, I'll wait 4 or 6 weeks maybe, and hopefully I'll hear back. But when you hear back, and this is actually the bigger, I suppose, part of my time at the moment, is actually benchmarking the improvements. Because you have to be able to understand kind of, well, we fine-tuned it now, we've trained it a bit more. What's the delta? What has changed in between the model that we had available to us before to now? And there's loads of different ways of trying to do that. At the very base level, you do these kind of n-gram style solutions where you're just checking how similar is it? Is it match exactly? If we could tweak it a little bit, or if a developer got at that code with a couple of small tweaks, would it do what we expected it to do from best practice point of view? So it's kind of, I think, early days understanding the methodology, certainly from our perspective, as to how you improve these models efficiently. And then to go back to, you know, the vast library of models that there are, well, how do you do this at scale? You cannot simply white glove each and every model. You're going to have to do this in somewhat of an automated way. And that, to me, now has led us to almost a full circle. We're using AI to benchmark AI and to train AI, right. You know? So this is super nuanced and convoluted, but we're getting there. We're getting
right.
There.
I mean, to get back to what I said earlier about nobody cares just how smart your model is, you know, a lot of the times when we're hearing about the latest ones, it's like somebody's talking about an F1, you know, sports car. Well, on the MMLU, you know, it's 2% better than the, you know, state of the art or whatever, but that means nothing in terms of like what it's going to cost you, or whether it's, you know, applicable to your business use case, or whether you have the resources, you know, to keep it going in production in a, you know, in a way that's meaningful. So I think, yeah, like what you said is very interesting. Something comes back to you and you have to come up with the benchmarks and then do the legwork, which sounds like very, you know, like time intensive, headcount intensive legwork sometimes. Anyway, passing the mic around, I'd love to hear, yeah, a little bit about training or the ongoing work involved in the maintenance and upkeep, et cetera.
The one thing I would say, Ben, to your point, you know, yes, more or less models are, you can choose one versus the other. You still have to do the work, Shane, as you said, right? To fine tune it, customize it, and evaluate. It's a cycle, right? You keep doing that till you match it to the metric. But what I would share is that, you know, if you look at models today, which out of the box, at least the aspirations that we have, is that they're so powerful that that delta work that you need to do to optimize it is much reduced compared to a previous life, you know, like a previous cycle. That's very important to know, because, for example, I ran a predictive AI image recognition company for almost 10 years, but this is 2014. And I can say that first 3 years, all we were doing is data acquisition, curation, cleanup, labeling, all of that. That took entire time. But today, you know, you take a really powerful out-of-the-box foundation model And even with 200 to 300 images, you're able to get to an acceptable point, right? I'm not saying that, you know, depends on the use case. So, but that's an important differentiation, which goes back to you can iterate fast, at least to say, okay, am I getting a product market fit? And then take that next step, which was much longer cycle before.
Oh, totally. I think we're standing on the shoulders of giants, to use that expression. You know, we're, you know, it is fine tuning. We're not building or creating that. We're fine tuning it. We're tweaking the parameters, as it were. So I do appreciate the fact that it is so much simpler now than it used to be. Definitely.
Yeah, because I spent, like I said, 3 years of my early days of the startup was just this. And the other thing is that you also have range of options, right? Like when we say customize the model, what exactly needs to happen? Because you can have very basic fine tuning. You can plumb it with RAG, with a little bit of your enterprise data, and you might have a good first baseline, but you have a spectrum. You can go for supervised tuning. You can go all the way to full fine tuning, but you don't have to. What we are seeing with the enterprises today is, again, there is a shift where initially in 2023, you would say, hey, I have all this data and I'm just going to full fine tune it, right? We are not getting into those kind of use cases anymore. You're only getting into, you know, fine tuning to the point where I can start getting my business outcome. That's the model customization effort. And we don't have so many examples where full fine tuning is needed or has been successful, because full fine tuning, where you're changing every single weight or parameter, it again goes back to the skill gap, right? You need to have that expertise in-house to do it. Otherwise, you're not going to be successful there. So there are a lot of things to balance, but it's not a first, second, or a third base where you want to start today when you're thinking of business cases.
That's an interesting point that you're raising there. Have you seen any consulting companies that specialize in fine-tuning models emerge over the last year because of exactly this knowledge gap in the big companies?
Yeah, Mira, they are. We are seeing, especially the system integration ecosystem, they're ramping up to be what you call AI MSPs, managed service providers. And in that spectrum, those services are essentially related to fine-tuning, data foundation, and model evaluation. Because those are the three kind of key points where you need that help if you don't have the talent in-house, or even if you're just trying to accelerate the pace at which you're taking these solutions to production. So you'll see a lot more of AI MSPs emerge as a future prediction, starting from which model to choose, how do I evaluate it, how do I fine-tune it, how do I plumb the data, and then get it into production.
Yeah, we've been pitched by some startups to come on the podcast doing both those things, labeling and cleaning and testing of data, and then also, you know, working on, like you said, a white glove fine-tuning experience and then trying to get you to your business outcome. All right, before we go, you're on a podcast, so you have to offer a prediction. You could be way off base and nobody will remember. If you are correct, people will say this person was on the money and you'll get credit for it. So we'll go around here to each of you. Where do you think the GenAI space, you know, is headed in the next year? And how much of that will be of use to the enterprise? You know, how much of that will move the needle from 80, 90%, you know, testing and 5% production to 70, 80% testing and 15% production?
Shane, we'll start with the predictions, then I can optimize for mine.
Well, you know, the one prediction I'm not going to go near is the regulatory and safety and ethics side of things. We've seen, obviously, in Europe, there's an AI Act and things like that coming down the tracks as well, too, and they've been signed. So I don't want to go there. I don't want to talk about it not happening. For me, I think, and I suppose, look, on a selfish note, enhanced customization and control is key. I think that's what will allow, you know, this gap that we have, this gap to production, to decrease, to move, you know, less and less from just purely proof of concepts and then nothing into a proof of concept that gets all the way out there as well, too. So, you know, advancements in techniques for controlling the outputs of the Gen AI models will enable businesses to better tailor that experience that they have with their AI-generated content you know, a bit more precisely to exactly what they need as well too. And obviously then, you know, that will help customers and end users, et cetera. Costs is a thing. I think we're very much in a gold rush at the moment where it's just build it and we'll figure it all out. But at some point, the hammer of costs is going to come down and we're going to have to understand that it's the same analogy as the cloud, right? The cloud is just somebody else's computer somewhere else. You know, right. AI takes compute, it takes bandwidth, it takes, you know, lots of processing, and there's costs involved too. And I think we're in a gold rush now where we're not really paying attention to the costs, but we will need to if we want for these products and solutions and applications to continue to exist.
If it's like cloud, then some big companies will be born that just manage your AI costs for you, right? That you just rely on them to help you sort through that stuff and make sure you're not overspending here.
There, Ben, you took my one prediction already.
Yeah. All right. Well.
Yeah, I think from the point of databases, we're going to see even tighter integration for embeddings. So databases will get even more vector capabilities for storing embeddings, for indexing these embeddings, and for performing vector search over them. Something exciting that I've heard that MongoDB might do is that we will have a brand new BSON type. So BSON is the standard for storing data from MongoDB documents on disk. So we're going to get a new BSON type that is specific for vectors, which will allow for more optimized storage of embeddings and for better integration for RAC applications.
Wow.
Cool.
So I'm thinking we will see a lot more from experimentation to implementation. That percentage, I'm thinking, should double this even as early as this year, because we are already seeing the initial trends. So I would say 40%, if I had to take a guess, we'll start moving. You'll start seeing the adoption in taking to production deployment. That's one. Second is... Right. Some of it is the excitement of being in the space, but I do think we will see a lot more use cases based on the multimodal capabilities, which we haven't seen a lot yet.
Right.
But I think those are a very different set of use cases, and we will start seeing those emerge.
Right.
Third is, the prediction is that we will still not see that killer Gen AI app in 2024. because we are very early in that life cycle. And
right.
I would say the fourth, which I touched upon, is kind of this growth of the managed service providers who give you an end-to-end, either from the service perspective or orchestration perspective, like pooling, right? A layer
right.
which would sit on top of the platform that provide core capabilities. You'll start seeing an influx of those either through startups or through system integrators, because that is what will lead to, you know, us going more and more towards building high value applications as opposed to doing, you know, point integrations.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, Stack Overflow has an enterprise business, and Mongo and Google Cloud, I'm sure, you know, we share some of the same large enterprise customers who, as we mentioned earlier, you know, are very averse in terms of their brand equity and, you know, just their security and governance about making mistakes in public. I think one of the things that was really helpful to Stack Overflow as we, you know, got ready to launch Overflow AI was the ability to invite developers into a beta test where they can make as many mistakes as it needs to, and they can help us iron out the bugs kind of behind the curtains. So I guess, yeah, one of the things that I'm curious about seeing in the next year is how folks, the comfort level, you know, of moving, as you said, from experimentation to production, and whether or not, you know, yeah, people will be willing to deal with some of the downside in order to capture some of that upside. To Shane's earlier point, you can't not move in this space. You can't, you know, do nothing.
Yeah.
That's not really an option for most companies. So how you do it and with what level of caution. All right, everybody, it is that time of the show. We're going to shout out somebody who came on Stack Overflow and shared a little knowledge. Awarded on March 30th to Thai Temple in TypeScript. How do I declare a function that returns a string type array? Thai Temple has given an answer, earned themselves a Lifeboat badge, and helped 55,000 people. So we appreciate it. As always, I am Ben Popper. I am the director of content here at Stack Overflow. You can find me on X at Ben Popper. Shoot us an email with questions or suggestions for the podcast. something you want to talk about, if you want to come on, it's just podcast@StackOverflow. And if you liked the show today, leave us a rating and a review. It really helps.
Shane McAllister, I'm a lead on the developer relations team here at MongoDB. And you'll find me on X at Shaney Mac. Not technical, not developer topics, usually old man shouting at the sky type stuff. Or LinkedIn, obviously, for the more technical, more developer-focused things. And look, if you want to come to MongoDB, check us out in terms of getting on board. Myself, Mira, the rest of the DevRel team, we run the Developer Center on MongoDB with all the articles, all the how-tos. So, and there's tons of Gen AI stuff there as well, too. So please check that out.
And Shane is too cautious to mention that we also have a podcast. Check out the MongoDB podcast. My name is Tony Miravoeva. I'm a senior developer advocate. But yeah, you can hear Shane leading most of our podcast episodes.
Hey everyone, I'm Miku Jha. I'm a director of Google Cloud Gen AI Partner Engineering. You can find me on LinkedIn for all things Gen AI and beyond. And, you know, my ask is just go try out all the Gemini models and see what you find. There's a lot of effort gone into that. It's a lot of fun to explore and always open to interacting, having those discussions. Reach out to me on LinkedIn and we can connect.
Wonderful. Thanks for listening, and we will talk to you soon.